This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A new president is in the White House calling for unity, and the former president faces an impeachment trial for a second time. It's our monthly full hour discussion of national politics with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, how are you?
I am fine, thank you, Michael. And by the way, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you so much. That was just a few days ago. I appreciate you saying that. Thank you so much, Ken. We're also joined, as always, by University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, good to have you back.
Thank you.
As always, we start this program with a question for you listeners, and it is our political junkie trivia question. Ken, what is this month's question?
Well, the news of the other day was that Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced her candidacy for governor of Arkansas, which was not a surprise, but the question is, who was the last White House press secretary who ran for office after leaving his or her job?
That's a tough question, Ken. That's a tough one to start this new year. And if you think you know the answer, if you're tough enough, 513-419-7100 is the number to call. And Ken, tell them what they'll win.
You win. That's a great prize. You win what's remaining of Michael's birthday cake.
I assure you, there is none of that remaining.
You win a political junkie button, actually.
Awesome. And those buttons are highly prized. 513-419-7100. If you know the answer to the question, who was the last White House press secretary who ran for office after leaving his or her job? This question comes in light of former press secretary under the Trump administration, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, declaring her candidacy for governor of Arkansas. We are talking national politics, and there's a lot to talk about for the next hour, and we want you to join us at 513-419-7100 or email your comments, your questions, your thoughts to talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. Ken, we've had so much happen since the last time you were on, and a great tragedy earlier this month with the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, which led to the second impeachment of President Trump. Even though he's out of office, he was impeached by the House, and now the trial is set to commence in the United States Senate. I get the sense that this country has dealt with so much trauma in recent years, particularly in the past year, with a difficult election that typically follows every 4 years, but on top of a deadly pandemic that has just changed our lives so much. I'm wondering if you think we would feel the way about this insurrection now if we hadn't experienced as much trauma. And I guess I'm asking, are we taking it seriously enough?
Oh, I absolutely think we are. I mean, of course, the impeachment of the president is terribly serious. But the fact is that the FBI and law enforcement authorities are going around the country trying to track down and arrest these people who just broke into the Capitol. I mean, anytime when you have a mob apparently instigated by the president of the United States, a mob running into the Capitol and saying, "Hang Mike Pence," or "Where's Nancy?" basically trying to find out where Nancy Pelosi was so they can find her as well. That is beyond insurrection. It's sedition, and it's frightening. And you know, a few months ago, when people were saying there was a talk in Michigan about trying to kidnap the governor there, Gretchen Whitmer, you said, "Boy, that sounds pretty unusual." But now it's almost become politics as usual, because the anger and the feeling, the sense that this was a stolen election by these nefarious forces is a very, very frightening thing that does not change, even though the occupancy of the White House has changed.
So the question that the Senate will consider is whether Donald Trump incited this insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. I want to read some reporting from The Washington Post that was published yesterday about Republicans backing away from confronting the former president and his loyalist. Quote, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced little more than a week ago that the mob that attacked the U.S. Capitol had been provoked by Donald Trump. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said Trump bears responsibility for failing to respond more quickly to the bloody incursion. And the Washington Post goes on to say, but that was then. The nation's two most powerful elected Republicans have signaled that they are ready to look past questions of responsibility for the violent effort to overturn the result of the presidential election, an attempt that left a Capitol police officer and four rioters dead as they maneuver to avoid a divisive battle within the Republican Party. Dr. Bloom, let's turn to you for analysis on that reporting and the state of things in the U.S. Congress following that insurrection. It seems unlikely, according to reports, that the Senate will convict Trump on this. And that's what provoked my question at the top of the show of whether we're taking this seriously enough. It seemed not that long ago that Republican leadership was extremely concerned about the role the president played in the insurrection. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about their approach now.
Well, this has been rapidly changing. There did seem to be a time when it was believable that we would have bipartisan support for impeachment. Even up until a few days ago, it seemed possible that McConnell might lead the charge and become a statesman. And in the last couple of days, we've seen some differences. We saw most of the Republicans trying to stop the entire process, only a few breaking ranks. But we've also seen some alternative ideas. So Tim Kaine of Virginia and Susan Collins of Maine, a Democrat and a Republican, are saying they're drafting this proposal to censure Trump, which is not an impeachment. It's not a conviction. It's more of a slap on the hand. And I think to a lot of people, that doesn't seem like enough. And this is where we're running into the problem of internal politics in the GOP. There are a lot of Republicans in the party organization and elected officials who believe that the party needs the insurrectionist base or the MAGA base to keep winning elections. And they think that if they distance themselves too far from Trump, that they might undermine their party's fortunes in the future. But at the same time, there are people in the Republican Party who think their only future lies in distancing their party from Trump. So part of what's playing out in Congress right now is partisan politics. But I think the more interesting story is intra-party politics in the GOP, and specifically what these defections tell us about where the party is going.
I think during the presidential campaign, particularly earlier last year when the primary was still going on, we spent some time talking about issues within the Democratic Party and its natural allies and whether there was too big of a rift between traditional Democratic voters and the progressive left, who may be more inclined to support a candidate like Bernie Sanders than Joe Biden. Dr. Bloom, is there such a rift in the Republican Party now that's possibly wider and more dangerous to their political concerns?
I think that's possible. I lean that direction. But every time I start to think, wow, this is an insurmountable rift, then a lot of Republicans come together and cooperate on something that really seems to be the MAGA line or party business as usual. So this could go one of two ways. You could see the Republican Party start to develop a more vocal faction that pushes back at MAGA and Trumpism in general. And maybe Trump falling from grace would help that. But you could also see a party that's casting about for the heir apparent to authoritarianism and trying to continue to whip up the base. Now, they'll run into a PR problem, because even though a lot of Republicans were, if not okay with the insurrection, not super against it, they might be against or troubled by continued violence or continued damage to government property. Who knows? But I think the next 4 years are going to be a big growing period for the GOP, and a lot of things will crystallize by 2024.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. We're joined by the political junkie Ken Rudin and University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom, here on Cincinnati Edition. Again, 513-419-7100. Ken, we saw 10 Republicans in the House join the Democrats in voting to impeach Donald Trump, and we expect at least a handful, maybe a few more than Mitt Romney in the Senate to vote that way. But we've also seen state Republican parties take some pretty extreme positions in recent weeks, particularly in Arizona and Oregon against mainstream Republicans. And we've seen the Republican Party of Texas adopt a slogan that was characterized as one that belonged to the QAnon conspiracy theory, "We are the storm." So I'm wondering your thoughts on the state of the Republican Party. Is it the party of Trump, or will Mitch McConnell be able to rein it in to be more his party?
I think Mitch McConnell tried to rein it in by giving out the signals a few days ago that the Republican Party, that basically Donald Trump was responsible for the insurrection and he should be held accountable and that there are consequences. And Kevin McCarthy didn't go as far, but the minority leader in the House basically said the same thing, that Trump should be held responsible. Then we saw that the 10 House Republicans who voted for impeachment, including Liz Cheney, who is the number three Republican in the House, they're all being challenged in 22 by with a primary challenge from the right. Dr. Bloom mentioned about coming to the Republican Party coming to terms in 2024. I don't think it'll last that long. 2022, we're seeing people like Governor Mike DeWine. We're seeing people like Senator Thune of South Dakota. We're seeing a lot of Republicans urged by Trump and Trump supporters to challenge these Republicans because they are not sufficiently Trump. So I don't think there's that big of a dilemma or a split in the Republican Party, as some are saying, in that I still think this is definitely a Donald Trump party. The fact that we saw the Republican Party in Arizona censuring Cindy McCain, for goodness sakes, because she voted for, I mean, she's not even a member, she's not even a party official, but because she had the temerity to vote for Joe Biden after Donald Trump insulted her husband, even after John McCain's death, over and over again. You expect her to vote for Joe Biden, but when you have Republican parties in Arizona, in Oregon, and others backing somewhat right wing, I mean, really right wing segments of the Republican Party, you know that this is still a Trump party. He may no longer be president. He may be hiding out in Mar-a-Lago somewhere, or Mar-a-Liason, wherever it is, wherever he's hiding. But the fact is that this is really not the kind of split in the Republican Party I would have thought. I think that a lot of, for example, one of the reasons Rob Portman, I think, is retiring is that this party is not becoming moderate. It's not becoming the way it was when Rob Portman first joined politics. It's becoming a Trump party even more so. And I think he just doesn't want any part of it. And I think that's I think most Republicans are coming to that realization.
So what does that mean, though, when a Republican senator who is a traditional mainstream Republican conservative like Rob Portman of Ohio, who served in the Bush administration and prior to that served as a congressman here in Cincinnati, when they start to depart the party, what kind of candidates should Ohio voters expect to see elevated based on what we know about the trajectory of the Republican Party today?
I think you almost answered your own question. When people like Rob Portman and you also have Richard Burr in North Carolina and Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, Republicans who are already announcing their retirement, you know that they are going to be succeeded, or at least hope to be succeeded, by more conservative, more Trumpian candidates. Sort of, I mean, we've heard the name Jim Jordan mentioned over and over again. There was some discussion about Jordan actually challenging Governor DeWine in 22 because Trump was encouraging a primary challenge. But with Portman leaving, why not Jim Jordan? I mean, Jim Jordan has raised a lot of money. He has a high profile in the Republican Party. You know that Donald Trump loves him. And in a state that has gone for Trump by at least 8 percentage points, 2 elections in a row, it's not out of the woods, not out of the ballpark to consider the fact that Jim Jordan could very well be the next senator from Ohio.
One of the Utah newspapers reported about Senator Mitt Romney, where he was quoted as saying, "You have many of the Trump supporters in elected office, senators, congresspeople, governors, continuing to say the same thing, that the election was stolen." This report was this week that Romney said that. He said on Fox News later, "You know what? I was a big Trump supporter. I was really pulling for Donald Trump, but he lost fair and square." Dr. Bloom, why are so few Republicans coming out and saying that? It seems as though there is not a base in reality where you can have a good faith conversation, debate, argument about the direction of the country when you are hesitant to acknowledge that truth.
Yes, this is one of the more concerning things that has developed in the last 4 years, but I don't think it's completely unexpected. Since the 90s and the culture wars, we've been documenting the rise of partisan polarization, and we've been watching as it slowly trickles down to the electorate and becomes more of social or affective polarization, where people only associate with people like themselves who agree. They start to sort into geographic areas with people who agree with them. And over the last decade or so, we've seen this become especially or asymmetrically bad on the right. So people who identify as Republicans tend to share multiple of the same identities, white identity, identity with law enforcement or the military, identity with a certain maybe rural way of life. And this creates a susceptibility to messaging along those lines. But it also puts people in a bubble. So if you are only surrounded by people like you and you only get your news from people who are trying to message or inflame people like you, there's not an opportunity to form a cross-cutting alliance or to learn other information. And it's very easy to get sucked into this other ecosystem that's based on a slightly distorted view of reality. And historically, there have been other episodes where there's been a faction of people who has a distorted view of reality. But we do live in a different era. This is the era of the internet and information. So we simultaneously have a base of voters who have access to more information than ever, but who also don't know what to do with it and are unfortunately falling prey to elites and politicians who are preying on this vulnerability and these insecurities.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. We'll take some comments now. And John is on the line. Hi, John. What's your question or comment?
Yes, guys. I just wanted to point out, I'm sure you guys are sharp enough to already know this, but everyone who congratulated President Biden on his win got in trouble, including the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine. And there's one politician, world leader, who congratulated Joe Biden that did not get in any hot water. I was wondering if you guys knew who that was.
You're talking about in trouble with the president, the previous president,
yeah,
Donald Trump?
In trouble with the former president, Mr. Trump.
Why don't you tell us who you're talking about?
Well, that person that did not get in any hot water with Mr. Trump was Vladimir Putin.
I knew he was going to say that. I knew he was going to say that.
John, thank you for the call. We appreciate you listening and sharing your thoughts with us. Thanks so much. Again, the trivia question this month is, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the former White House press secretary under President Trump, declared her candidacy for governor of Arkansas in 2022. And Ken Rudin's question is, who was the last White House press secretary who ran for office after leaving his or her job? We've got a few people on the line who want to try their hand at answering this question. We'll start with Alicia. Is it Alicia?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Alicia.
Please, go ahead, Alicia.
A totally wild guess. I think I know it's wrong, but I'm guessing it was Jody Powell.
Ken.
Jody Powell, of course, who was Jimmy Carter's press secretary. Jody Powell never ran for public office. He ran a consulting firm in Washington, a successful one, never ran for office. Hamilton Jordan, who worked with Jody Powell, did run for the Senate, but he was not the press secretary.
Alicia, good guess. Thank you for trying and giving us a call. 513-419-7100. Ray wants to take a try at this question. Hi, Ray. What's your answer?
Yes, so I was thinking, might it have been Jimmy Breslin?
Ken?
Jimmy, oh, wow, I love Jimmy Breslin. Of course, the only time Jimmy Breslin ran for office was when he ran for city council president of New York City in the 1969 Democratic primary. But Jimmy Breslin was too smart to ever be anybody's press secretary.
Ray, good guess. Thank you for calling and taking a try on that. We appreciate it. 513-419-7100. Let's go to Michael. Hi, Michael. What's your answer? Do we have Michael on the line? I'm not hearing him. Such a nice
hey, this
name.
Is Michael.
Oh, there he is.
This is Michael.
Hi, Michael. What's your answer?
Well, I'm going to, my answer is Pierre Salinger. I believe he ran for the United States Senate at one time.
Ken?
Pierre Salinger is the correct answer.
How about that?
Well, let me just explain quickly. Pierre Salinger was the press secretary under John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. He quit to run for the Senate from California. When the incumbent died, he was appointed briefly. But when he ran for office in November of 1964, he lost to the Republican song and dance man, George Murphy.
How about that? Thanks for the great question, Ken. And well done, Michael. Love it when a Michael gets the correct answer. I'm going to place you on hold, and our producer, Selena Reeder, is going to get some information from you and send you one of those highly coveted political junkie buttons. We're going to continue with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Dr. Rachel Bloom, along with your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, and University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. You can join us as well at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. We got an email from Janelle asking, quote, "Aren't we really looking at a mass case of Stockholm syndrome? How long do you think it will take for things to even out?" Ken, your thoughts on Janelle's question?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question. And I don't know if I would call it Stockholm syndrome, but look, this is in some ways, it really is a cult. The fact that there are so many millions of people who really believe that the election was stolen, despite comments and statements from Trump's own people that it may have been the most honestly conducted election in history. I'd like to see what happened after the 2022 primaries. Trump is urging a lot of challenges to them, to Republicans who may not be completely loyal. If these Trumpsters can be beaten back, then maybe some sort of normalcy can come back to politics, if that's possible. But if the Trumpsters win, if the people who have the, as they say, the temerity to say that Biden won, like Mike DeWine or John Thune or people like that, then nothing changes, and we're back to 26. Then we're back to 2022 again and 2024 again. So let's see what happens in next year's elections, governor, senator, Congress. Remember those 10 Republicans who voted for impeachment. If they don't survive their challenge, if they don't survive their reelection, then I hate to say that Trumpism is still here to stay.
We got an email from Wayne asking, Democrats seem to consistently outspend Republicans at national levels, but trail badly at the state and local levels. How to get more Bloomberg-type money into those races? Dr. Bloom, that's an interesting question, because we have seen, while the Democrats made strides, winning the White House, winning the Senate, and now fully controlling the executive and the legislative branches of the federal government, they've lost a lot of ground over the years in state legislatures. Is there any need in the Democratic Party to perhaps funnel more money into those efforts, particularly when you think about a year like this where the census is conducted and in many states where the legislature has influence or complete control over how congressional seats are drawn?
Well, the short answer is more money probably wouldn't hurt, but you're right. I think the question embedded in this question is a big one, which is why have Democrats lost so much power at the state and local level? What could be done about it? And this has been a process that it pretty much started when lines were redrawn from the 2000 census. And a lot of districts and a lot of states were severely gerrymandered. You have that on one hand. Then you have some other quirks of our electoral system, the winner takes all single member districts. And you put all of it together with the fact that, at least for the last couple of decades, Republican voters have just turned out at higher rates. And the reality is that to win an office at any level, but particularly at the state level, Democrats have to outperform Republicans in turnout and a lot of other measures to overcome the structural bias towards Republicans. So money could help. In Georgia, there was certainly a lot of outside spending on those state Senate races, but it was also at a different time. It had a very big meaning for control of the Senate. If that kind of money poured into more state and local races, it's quite possible that we could see some fortunes change. But we've also learned over the years that money doesn't always mean you win an election. And that's where we have to think about this bigger structural issue of how districts are drawn and how representation is conceived in our country right now.
Can I expand on that? Because Dr. Bloom is exactly right. Remember, in 2016, Hillary Clinton far outspent Donald Trump and lost the election. And think of what happened in 2020. I mean, you think, well, Joe Biden was elected president, but he was elected president by the barest of margins, at least in the Electoral College. If you look at the House, Republicans picked up 11 seats. They picked up governorships. They only lost one Senate seat. And the only reason the Democrats won the Senate was because of those two runoffs in January in Georgia. In state legislatures, they got clobbered. So I don't know if it's money or if it's message, but it just seems like the Democrats seem to be more hesitant about just getting angry and getting insistent and making its message known. Because if you think of 2020, I would think it was just as good as a Republican year as it was for the Democrats, other than the fact that Joe Biden was elected president.
We got a comment from Marianne who says, I'm not so certain Jim Jordan would be a shoo-in for Rob Portman's Senate seat. Jordan's district is among the most tortuously gerrymandered in the state. I don't believe he would have great statewide support. But to Marianne's comment and what you just said, Ken, when you look at a map of the county by county results across the country in the colors of red for the Republican candidate and blue for the Democratic candidate, it looks like a lot of red. Of course, the context is often lost when images like that go viral online, that there are more people who tend to live in the areas that are blue. But is the ideological divide in this country driven now primarily by geography? We see in the metro counties, the populated counties, the densely populated counties, they trend Democratic. The rural areas are very, very red.
Well, I mean, you know, every time I look at the map of Ohio and I look at the way the congressional maps have been drawn up and redistricted, my goodness, I think the state seems to be pretty evenly divided, but because of redistricting, it seems like the Republicans have an overwhelming number of congressional seats, far more than their population would suggest. That's one of the reasons a lot of people think that Tim Ryan, the congressman from Northeast Ohio, might run for the Senate, because if the Republicans carve up his district for 2022, he may not have a district to run in, and not because he's not popular there, but because they keep changing the boundaries. So a lot of it is redistricting. A lot of it is who controls the maps in state capitals. But one more thing about what Marianne says, she's absolutely right. Jim Jordan may be popular on Fox News. I don't know how he would do in a state primary. I mean, he's talking about the lieutenant governor, John Husted running, Steve Stivers. The congressman is looking about it. And maybe even Dan Whaley,
Nan Whaley, the Dayton mayor.
The mayor of Dayton, yeah, I mean, she was considering running for governor. Maybe she'll run for the Senate. There's nothing is a shoe in 2022, but you just know that when you have a name Jim Jordan, who is just so popular with that base and national base, and his ability to raise money, he certainly has to be listed as a possible front runner for the race if he wants it.
The noise you just made while searching for Jim Jordan's name is something
that
I'm going to make.
That wasn't a noise.
I'm going to make that. That's my new ringtone, Ken. I'm going to Josh Elstro.
There was a traffic accident that. Outside. I didn't make, believe me, I don't make noises, okay?
That's fair. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join this conversation. And we find Tony on the line now. Hey, Tony, what's your question or comment?
Hello, good afternoon. I just wanted to kind of pivot a little bit here, if I can, within this conversation. And I had a question slash comment regarding the responsibility of media to fairly portray the credentials of people who are speaking to issues. I've noticed for a long time within the U.S., many media outlets will tend to put people who are, you know, tenured professors and who've had pages and decades of experience within an industry up against people who have no experience and no credentials to speak to issues and to speak about their opinions on matters. And I feel that there's some amount of responsibility that should be held by those media companies to ensure the people who they're putting in front of their cameras, the people that they're putting out there to speak to issues, have credentials and have that experience. I can get the idea that lay people should wondering and on the fact that many of our media sources are juxtaposing positions as equal, even though in truth they're not.
Tony, we appreciate that. Thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. We do appreciate that. I'll turn to Dr. Rachel Bloom from the University of Oklahoma for that, being a very smart professor who can speak authoritatively on these issues. We do see, particularly in the age of the democratization of media, where so many more people have access to bullhorns and people gain traction, there is this battle between information and entertainment. So what are your thoughts about what Tony had to say?
Well, I agree, obviously, that more expertise would be helpful. And it's, you know, I've had personally frustrating experiences where I get to listen to someone who really has no more expertise than the next person talk about politics on national television and get a lot of stuff wrong. But beyond the personal level, I think this conflict between entertainment and information is central here, because it really started when the Fox News model emerged, this idea of hiring someone who's an entertainer or an actor rather than a trained journalist to give the news. And it's continued to evolve over time. And the democratization of the internet, you could say, is just that idea blown up. Now, if you think you can produce some interesting or entertaining content, you can start a YouTube channel, or you can put stories up on Instagram, and you can gain a lot of followers and traction. And what it creates is this difficulty in cutting through the noise. Who do I listen to and who do I not listen to? And it's one thing when people are still going to traditional media, even if we want to include right-leaning traditional media as gatekeepers. But it's another thing when someone decides all of that is fake news or all of that is the deep state and completely goes underground, will only take information from from blogs of like-minded people or from forums and so forth. And that is a new problem. It's not happened before because it's not been possible for that to happen before. And it coincides with this general decline in respect for expertise, but also a sense of anti-elitism, of frustration with people who are perceived to be really out of touch with the rest of the country, whether or not that's true of that particular expert.
Ken, you've been in political media for a long time, and you've seen this evolution towards partisan and ideological presentations in mainstream outlets. It seems to have picked up steam in recent years, and particularly during the Trump years, because he was such an outspoken consumer of content. He sat and watched television nearly all day long and live tweeted what he was watching. What do you think the impact of the Trump legacy will be on the way the news is handled, particularly in the White House briefing room, since we're talking about press secretaries and such today?
Well, I have been impressed with Jen Psaki, watching her talk to the media compared to what we've seen with the last three or so Trump press secretaries. But I have to admit, I am alarmed and disheartened, I guess, watching. And look, do I blame most of it on Trump? I do. Anybody who comes into office and talks about the media as the enemy of the American people, to me, that sounds Soviet-esque. I mean, it just sounds, or Stalin-esque, it just sounds very frightening. But at the same time, in the past, I'm hearing news reporters talk more analysis and opinion than they ever have before. I remember, look, I'm old enough to remember Walter Cronkite in 1968 announced that Lyndon Johnson has lost the country because of the Vietnam War. And everybody was shocked that somebody as respected as Walter Cronkite would give his opinion. I'm not a fan of journalists, and I find myself in this category, giving opinion and telling people that, well, he or she is lying. But at the same time, I feel like we were just egged onto it by a president who just wanted to make this a battle, and we got suckered into it. I'm hoping that, look, every president has problems with the media. Obama had an enemies list. Nixon had an enemies list. That's what happens. I'm just hoping that somehow the normalcy, that whatever normalcy means, that we've had pre-Trump can come back in these days. More respect on both sides, less opinion making, and just saying, look, yeah, and just the right to know by the media of what's true and what's not.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to share your thoughts with us as well. Kate is on the line next. Hi, Kate. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yeah, you guys are kind of touching on this, but I wondered if you could speak to kind of more than the Republican Party shifting to the party of Trump, but this movement towards the party of QAnon and conspiracy theory. My mom is a boomer and has been a Republican her whole life, and it has been wild to watch her move towards Marjorie Taylor Greene and QAnon conspiracies over even Republican policies. Frightening.
Thank you, Kate. We appreciate the call and your listenership. Thanks so much. We'll let our guest analyze that. Dr. Bloom, your work in studying the Tea Party, which preceded where we find the Republican Party today, it was cited in a recent article at The Atlantic. And I'm wondering if you might help Kate out there with her question.
Yes, QAnon is something I think about a lot now, which I think it's increasingly on the radar of people who are paying a lot of attention to politics right now, maybe more than that, because there does seem to be a split emerging in the GOP electorate, and now we're starting to see it manifest in elected officials, between people who are maybe traditional conservatives and people who are more of what we would call a reactionary conservative. So they're just reacting to any perceived change or threat to their way of life. And that is one piece of the puzzle. But I think another piece of the puzzle is that this year has been a dumpster fire. So as people have been in lockdown and confused and not sure who to trust for information and annoyed that they have to be at home, you see more and more people turn online for community, as we all have. But sometimes that community means following breadcrumbs from Q or being on Parler or Reddit and kind of engaging in these sub-worlds. And as that proliferated, these sub-worlds started to become part of the general conservative conversation. It's tough because conspiratorial thinking is really, really hard to get someone out of. The whole idea of a conspiracy is that it's something that you will never prove false. So if you believe that there's a deep state and there are these child sex rings and all of the QAnon kind of things, there's no real evidence someone could present to you that would say, this is really not happening. Because anything that you hear to the contrary, you can just say, well, but that's fake news. That's the lying mainstream media and so forth. So it gets into this feedback loop. And we've seen things a little bit like this before. You can think about maybe the John Birch Society, but the way that these conspiracy theories are able to spread now in an age of the internet at a time when everyone's pretty much locked inside with their computers for company is new and is concerning.
More of your—
I just answer that. I think what Rachel said is very important. I think the coronavirus is also it seems like there's more appetite for conspiracy theories because people, so many people don't even believe why we are in this lockdown, why people think we should take a mask, wear a mask when President Trump said, no, you don't need to wear a mask. It's not much worse than the flu. And you're right, Dr. Blum, you're right. I mean, there was the John Birch Society. There have been conspiracy theories and there have been reactionaries in the Republican Party. But when you have members of Congress, you know, like, for example, Taylor Greene,
Marjorie Taylor,
who on the first day of Congress and now calling for the impeachment of Joe Biden, and you have people like Lauren Boebert walking into Congress insisting on carrying a gun and talking about that there was that these theories where they were child sex slaves and it started in a pizza joint with Hillary Clinton. I mean, it borders on insanity, and I think it's far beyond anything we've ever seen before. And the fact is, we've had marches in Skokie by the Nazis. We've had things like that in the past, but we never had a president who encouraged it. And that was the most frightening thing at all. And that's why the more the Republican Party can separate, if it can, from Donald Trump and Trumpism, is our only chance of getting back to normalcy.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We've got just a few minutes left with our good friends, the political junkie Ken Rudin and University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Blum. We got a comment from Kevin who says, Trump said he could shoot someone and get away with it. He was responsible for the Trump insurrection. We got a comment from Eva. Why does the previous president, even without the power of the office, enjoy influence with impunity? Why does the cult not diminish? And we'll go to the phone lines now where we find Bruce. Hi, Bruce. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. My comment is on your radio station. Seems like the news should be unbiased and objective. But last year, I heard on your radio station that Trump had not built 1 mile of new wall yet. The same day, when I was driving and changed the station, I heard on NPR News the Border Patrol in Texas said that they had just finished the 100th mile of brand new wall. So I have to listen to Fox News and NPR to try to combine all the information that you get to try to figure out the truth. And then you have somebody like Ken Rudin on there saying that he wants everybody to be objective, and he's one of the worst, most democratic, left-leaning people you have on the station. So it seems like if you guys want to get more objective, you should start with yourselves.
All right, Bruce, thanks for listening, and hope you have a great weekend. Appreciate the call and the feedback. Ken, you were name-checked there if you care to answer Bruce.
Well, you know, I mean, of course, Bruce has no idea how I vote. And if he looked at listened to any of my comments of previous presidents, Bush, Clinton, Reagan, Obama, anybody, both Bushes, he'll understand something differently. But I will be the first to admit that the rhetoric that's come out of Donald Trump, the lies, the incivility, the lack of comedy, the lack of truth, the bullying, I have not stayed silent with Donald Trump. And I know I have disappointed many friends who always saw me as completely objective. And I do see myself that way, but not when it comes to breaking traditional norms like decency and honesty. And if I've disappointed people because of my comments about Donald Trump, I do apologize.
And while we always appreciate and accept and encourage criticism of the work here, I should note, Bruce referenced this station reporting about no single mile of border wall being built and then hearing on NPR that that was not the case. Well, this is an NPR member station, Bruce, just to clarify, and we do appreciate you listening anyway. We've got time for one more quick call from William. I've got about 30 seconds for you, William. What's your question or comment?
Okay, well, I've solved the mystery.
Uh-oh.
Where all the rancor and the insanity is coming from WLW. If you'll listen to that station, I dare anyone to believe that they're getting away with what they're doing. They definitely inspired and incited this insurrection. That's WLW, Bill Cunningham, and Mike McConnell, and the rest of them. I dare anybody to listen.
Thank you, William. We do appreciate that. And, you know, Dr. Bloom, that is a significant development on the media landscape that we don't talk about enough is AM radio. You know, we talk a lot about Fox News or some of these strange websites that have emerged, but AM radio goes unchecked all across this country into the ears of people, and it is often just slanted right-wing information and talking points that are reiterated hour after hour after hour with no alternative viewpoints presented. Is that a problem?
Well, it certainly affects a lot of people. It's not a new problem. I remember growing up on Rush Limbaugh anytime my dad was driving anywhere. So these kinds of stations have existed for a very long time. There are more of them now, and they proliferate on podcasts, which is reaching a whole different set of listeners. But there are some fairness doctrines that do allow these stations to have a bias. Basically, any viewpoint is allowed to express itself on radio within certain limits. So even though it's frustrating to flip the dial and hear someone saying things you know are not true, it's legal, and it is democracy.
Ken, in our last minute together, let's talk about unity. That's the message that's coming from President Biden. And
oh, shut up.
So clever, you. So mean and so impartial.
I'm so upset about the previous caller, but I'm sorry. Let me just say one more thing. If he had listened to me in 2010 and 2014 talking about the failures of Obama and Obamaism, he wouldn't see me as the liberal that he sees me now, but okay, I'll stop being defensive. Yes.
I can hear you taking your earrings out. You're ready to scrap on the sidewalk with this guy, and I'm here for it.
I'm sorry.
Very quickly, we've got about 30 seconds now. Joe Biden's talking unity. What kind of hope should we have that we can start to return to just our regular differences and conversations about policy?
There's the one thing to talk about unity. It's one thing to talk about giving up principles. And when the Democrats insist on keeping their liberal principles, Republicans will say, well, that doesn't sound like unity to me. Unity coming from one person is a sellout from others. It's going to be a tough couple of years.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie and a very nice guy, I promise. And we also have been joined by our good friend, the University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. I'm so glad to have you both here in this new year, and I am anxious to see what the world looks like a month from now in February when we get together again. Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel, who answered the phone calls today. We appreciate that, Nick. And our technical director, Josh Elstro. This theme music was composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online anytime you want. at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.